Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diana.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I feel like my reality is a labyrinth and I am caught up in this dream.
But not David Bowie, the labyrinth.
Not Dave. That was my line. We don't even confer before these recordings.
You never confer.
You and I are so like the same era. Yeah, but David Bowie's labyrinth had a massive impact on my life. Mm. There was some scene where there was like a, I can't remember her name. Was it Julia Gardner? No, not Julia
Jennifer Connelly.
Jennifer Connelly. Yeah. I think she had like a lipstick, like a lip salve or something in it.
And you wanted
and
it.
I wanted it so badly. By the end of the film, I was like, Mum, I need
some lipstick.
I need a red lipstick.
I need your lipstick.
Or whatever colour it was. But that was actually about possessions being charged and having like talisman. Mm. There was something about the lipstick that I think gave the cat. I can't actually remember, but there was something about it. Mm. That it wasn't about it being lipstick. And even though I loved dressing up when I was a kid, but it was more about the energy force of an object.
Well, what you bestow onto it.
Yeah. And kind of like supernatural or...
Yeah, because there's that sci-fi bit with that old lady with a bag on her back and she goes, you want your dolly? Here's your dolly. And then it's terrifying and all the stuff that she like cares for, suddenly she's like terrifying. It's like a horror movie.
So today's guest, bringing it back to... I mean, David Bowie was art, but anyway.
Yeah.
Bringing it back to art. I have come in on the train today and I was just thinking like, it's almost like the artwork's begun already because today's guest's work, every time I've seen it, I feel like I'm kind of in a reality, you know, but it's not reality. And you're obviously totally aware it's not reality because you're in an art gallery like the times I'd seen at Matt's gallery or at Tate or even abroad, I think at Venice and different places where I've seen his work. But I remember one time I was in the Tate and I just got trapped in the work and I couldn't work out which door it was to get out of.
The same.
And it was so embarrassing, but at the same, and it was almost like panic attacky. Mm. I think I was a bit stressed at the time, but at the same time, it was like really humorous. And I love that idea that it's sort of like super serious. There's this political kind of undertone, is that the right word? Well, anyway, there's a political kind of charge throughout the work, even in the titling of the work. This current show at the Hayward Gallery, which is where we're sat right now, is called Extinction Beckons, which is a very poetic, it sounds like a kind of book title. So there is this kind of like element of politics, of maybe like entropy, maybe like end of the world, but there's also this humour and a kind of like joy in objects that have maybe lost their purpose or have like moved in time. And there's also this kind of like idea of liminality and like being in a dream state in between something and maybe the end of an era going into a new era.
Yeah, political. It feels like a political era when you change sort of governments, for example, there's been some sort of democracy breakdown and this is the remnants that have been left behind.
And also deeply personal. And I think often that's not mentioned in regards to our guest today. And that's actually something for me that I really want to discuss today. So we are at the Hayward. This is an epic show. And I use the word epic because it's reconstructing works from the past. So it's a huge retrospective. But this isn't a normal retrospective where you have paintings in crates and then you like ship them around the world and get them here. This is like hundreds and hundreds of tiny objects which have had to be sort of stored away all over in different places across Europe, across the UK, and then brought back together and then built like a kind of film set or something. You know, it's like
feel filmic.
It's that kind of detail, though. There's so many objects in this show, and I really recommend everyone coming down to the Hayward and buying a ticket and seeing this, or membership or whatever. But you have to see this, because this art is for the people. It's for all of us, and it's probably the most public artwork in a weird way of the whole time we've done talk art, because I just think it's so inclusive. And
let's get to our guest.
Yeah. Anyway, we would like to welcome to talk art the one and only
Mike Nelson.
Nice to meet you both.
Nice to meet you too, Mike Nelson, RA.
Yes, I have that at the end of my name.
When did that occur?
Maybe, I don't know, about 8 years ago, maybe. I can't remember, actually. Sort of, it was kind of, quite a strange sort of thing to have to decide on, in a way, which was a nice thing to be asked.
But is it a decision, though?
It is a decision, yeah. Some people don't go with it, and some people do. So, you know, I've got friends that perhaps might have been, but said no. So it's not for everybody. I mean, certainly the RA's reputation, perhaps in the mid-20th century, wasn't something most people want to be associated with. But
sure.
And obviously mid-century before, one would sort of. But I think of recent times, it's really, you know, changed its kind of image, and it's the kind of people that are actually within the RA, which kind of makes it far more appealing. And also the schools. I mean, it's probably the best school in London now, sort of. A lot of the reason why is because it's actually paid for. So there's not many places you can go to and study for free and actually have a bursary, which was the norm in my day. But I mean,
where did you study?
I was at Reading University, and then Chelsea School of Art, because I was with Rebecca sort of years ago. But
Mike's good friends with Rebecca Warren.
Well, actually, the other thing I wanted to say about you is that you're an artist, and you really are. I mean, every single artist I've mentioned I'm doing this interview, including Rebecca Warren, and Rebecca actually said how thrilled she was that you'd been given this opportunity of this show, because she feels like often the kind of work you're making might not get the opportunity to have kind of large scale, you know, platforms, and it's great that you do.
Yeah, I think it's quite hard for an institution to convince their board that they're going to get the numbers through the doors on the reputation of my name alone, because I'm not, even though I've done big shows in big places like the Pavilion and Turner Prize and stuff, I'm probably not such a household name. And a lot of the reason is because the work, you know, only manifests for that one period of time. So I can't tour it around the world. So you can't make one work and then tour it like, you know, say a sculpture, a painting, or even a video installation, you know, because they've got to be rebuilt each time. So if you miss it, you miss it.
Why do you set that rule for yourself? Because they're longer to put up than they're actually exhibited most of the time.
Yes.
Why have you given yourself that rule that once it's like a happening, I guess. It feels like if you were there, you had to be in the room where it happened. Yeah. And then once it's gone, it's gone.
Well, I think years ago, I think I was quite, back in the 90s probably, I was kind of interested in the idea of not being consumed, I suppose. I suppose that idea of freedom and that kind of consumption by other structures. And I suppose at the time, the market was one structure you could be consumed by. And advertising was another, I suppose, that I saw artworks being subsumed into somehow, and marketing structures. And I suppose making work in such a way that I did, it somehow did sidestep that. To a certain point, I do feel slightly that my critique of my own self in the Pavilion in Venice, which is a work I absolutely loved, but I did feel somewhat like I'd made this huge kind of flagship sort of piece of advertising for a huge kind of structure, which is a very commercially based sort of structure ultimately. And so in many ways, since that point, I haven't built many of the multi-room pieces, because it's somehow this kind of idea of these immersive environments, you know, whether it be sort of like in theatre or in sort of restaurants or whatever, felt somewhat like they'd somehow commodified that idea. And I was, it kind of didn't really quite ring. So more recently, I mean, that's the Asset Strippers and the more kind of sculptural shows I've been doing since. That's partly the reason for that. But back in the 90s, that's why I was kind of somehow trying to avoid that. I mean, but also I enjoy making them. So I suppose it was, I think sometimes artists, especially perhaps these days, kind of slightly get it wrong in that they want to make something that somehow makes them successful, or, you know, whether that be commercially or sort of like whatever, when really you just want to just do what you fancy and what you enjoy. And then, you know, hopefully it just comes to you, you know, whatever you need, sort of ultimately. And I've been lucky in that, even though perhaps I haven't been the most financially successful in the art world, I've managed to have a career making what I like that's been paid for by other people. I mean, you know, in another life I might have been a builder, but people be telling me what to build, whereas now I can build what I fancy.
If you think back to that time, to the kind of late 80s, early 90s, when you started to really break through, there wasn't really many other people at all doing the kind of installations that you were creating, if you want to call them installations, because I'd be interested actually to see how you would describe them yourself. But what was it like to take on that kind of challenge? Or did you just not, you just did it because you wanted to do it?
I think going back to Reading, I was quite a product of Reading. You know, in a lot of the tutors teaching there, you know, Richard Wilson, Ron Hazelden, Bill Colbert, Mark Camille Shemovitz, kind of were all kind of expansive, sort of whatever you'd call, kind of installation makers, film, sort of video, sort of sound. And I'm very much a product of that kind of era, an epoch, all those artists that squatted the sort of wharfs down in the East End, sort of like back in the 70s, you know, 60s and 70s. So I must give some credit to them. When I fell into it and just felt, you know, like a pig in muck, really, that was me. I was kind of happy building big things and sort of enjoying myself. And
was you a builder anyway, or did you build things growing up as a kid? Was you someone
No, because my dad was a mechanic on the big knitting machines in the factories in the Midlands. And then he sort of like worked his way up into running the factories and managing them, which he hated, but he loved, you know, but really it was much more of a mechanical, like engineering mind on him. And he was always making things for us back at home. And he used to bring back the big resin drums full of these spools and the odds and sods from the huge, you know, these are huge knitting machines, the length of this room, sort of from the factories, and put it in the corner and I'd make things out of that.
Would
sort
you?
Of, so I'm actually doing the same thing I was doing then, really, sort of just collecting larger amounts of stuff.
But, did he see the work? Has he seen the work in his lifetime?
He's dead now, unfortunately.
But did he see the work when you...
Yeah, yeah, he used to help me. Like,
did he?
Oh, yeah, every now and again. Like, he did all the locks on the ICA show. I remember the door handles and stuff. And I remember him doing the Turner Prize in 2001 and he came along and said, I've just been chatting to a nice chap. I think he was a security guard or something. And I'd spotted him earlier on, but it was Nick Sirota, which speaks well of both of them because, you know, both were kind of happy to talk on a level that kind of, you know, didn't really mind who they were, sort of like just having a nice chat while my dad was fixing a lock on the front door.
Wow.
With the first Turner Prize piece. So,
and this is Nick Sirota, used to run the Tate.
Yes.
So your dad was having a chit-chat with.
Yes, but he didn't know who he was. Like, dad wouldn't really know who...
Well, this building thing is great because there's a quote here where you said, half the time I spend it, this is being an artist, half the time I spend it as a builder, I look like a builder, I behave like a builder to some degree, but ultimately my head doesn't know that. My head is somewhere else.
Yes, well, that's it always amuses me slightly because, I mean, you know, all my dad's family, you know, came from the textiles factories. My grandfather, my mum, my godmother, my dad, my aunt and uncle, they're all in the factories in this small rural village in the Midlands called Shepshed, or Sheep's Head, which is where they would have brought the head of sheep to sort of be shorn to kind of make the textiles. And then my mum's family were painters and decorators and plumbers, and then before that, miners in a place called Colville. So it is like something out of some sort of Dickensian sort of English story, isn't it, in many ways? Kind of, and in between that was a redundant forest on an old volcano. You can't imagine such a thing. It sounds quite romantic, but it's probably not if you go back there now, but still.
It feels like literature, like you're talking about Dickensian. Yes. your worlds feel like you're... And I know you're a big reader and literature does channel into...
I kind of wasn't. I mean, I kind of went to reading, I remember, on a French exchange years ago because I was so homesick and it kind of, like, taught me to read. And I've had periods when I've read a lot. And again, through my 20s, I read a hell of a lot, sort of a... You know, and I still read now, but not as much as I should. I'm a slow reader. I mean, they kept me down at school when I was a child because I was a slow reader, sort of. So I didn't, you know, I was the oldest in the year, you know, an August birth, but which was a godsend for me ultimately. So, but, and then when I left college, I became a builder.
I did train.
I mean, I followed a builder around, sort of like being told to mix up buckets of muck and chuck it in holes, you know, which is what I've been doing since, really. it was kind of, and in fact, sort of like, you know, one of those tutors, Richard Wilson, built his house with him. We ripped it all out, and then the builder came, and I worked with the builder then, and then I went on working with the builder for another year or two. But yeah, so he was one of my tutors. He's a lovely man. Again, he's sort of like, I think when he took me on as a builder, you know, he was pretty at his, you know, prominent sort of like in British sculpture, and he'd just chat away to me and sort of like, you know, work side by side like a couple of builders eating cheese cobs of a
sounds like heaven.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was nice. Yeah, it was really nice.
Easy life.
I remember pulling up a big marble fireplace and dropping it on my toe whilst balancing on all the open joists that went all the way down to the bottom floor. Bloody hell, that hurt, sort of like. Ooh. But, yeah, so anyway.
What can you tell us about Matt's gallery? Because Matt's gallery, to me, is such a radical, vital, important space, and it's really singular in what its kind of mission has been over the years. And how did you come to sort of collaborate with them?
Yeah, well, so I think singular is the right term, and singular is Robin Klasny in the end, sort of who runs kind of Matt's gallery. You know, it is like an artist collective, but it's very much run by the maverick man himself, Robin, sort of like who was my external, you know. We said earlier, my external assessor at Reading was Felida, which is, you know, obviously a sad and shocking time that she's just died. And my external at Chelsea was Robin Klasny. So he was interested in the work, and it's kind of a courtship with Robin. Well, it was then anyway, sort of like, you know, you kind of, he shows interest. He said, you know, if you make something, you know, come and show me, sort of like, you know, we'll have a chat. So every time I'd made another show in some strange space somewhere in, normally in Britain, but I'd go along with the slides and, you know, transparencies. We'd get them on the light box and we'd have a chat about them, and then there'd be a sort of lingering conversation on the doorstop, you know, on the way out, sort of like, you know, with a few sort of come hither eyes, but sort of like, you know, until the moment when he said yes, you know, he asked me out for a show, as it were, sort of kind of nice, you know. It was, yeah, it took a few years, and he was very sort of, he's very generous, you know, when it comes to the work, you know. It's, he really invests in it, sort of like, you know, about thinking about it, about looking at it. Even though sometimes you realise in time that he doesn't really understand all the reference points, perhaps you're coming at with it, but more like in a felt way, an empathetic way, he kind of understands the work. And he's very sort of like, you know, he's very sort of sensitive in that respect. So, yeah, in 96, I think, or 95, was it? I did the first show there, I think, 96, January. Trading Station, Alpha CMA, which was a sort of a huge warehouse of shelving, sort of, which when you walked in, it was almost like a kind of repository of all the sort of like detritus of the East End, which was, you know, there's a lot of it in those days. Kind of, there were sort of redundant sort of like yards and, you know, spaces that don't exist anymore, which are full of old car parts, doors, tyres, whatever, sort of. And I just collected it all up in my old pickup truck and sort of like drive it back. Built a load of shelving, sort of, say, like a warehouse. And when you walked into it, it was just that. You know, it was formally inviting and interesting, sort of like a, I think somebody described it like a sculptor's repository. But when you got to the centre, there was a sort of a hut built into the centre of it.
You could go in?
Yeah, well, you could stand up on a crate and put your head inside. Then it was only the height of, you know, you could only stand on all fours, sit inside. Yeah, yeah. And strewn around on the floor was a load of old chewed bones. A blanket and a dog bowl, but there's also a television and a book called Hard to Be a God, which is upside down, so it read as dog. And it was a sort of reference points to sort of to a book by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky, who also wrote a book called Roadside Picnic, which became Stalker by Tarkovsky. And it was a reference to that. It was also a reference to Heart of Darkness, because there's a moment where sort of, I don't know if you ever remember, sort of Apocalypse Now, Easy Ride, Dennis Hopper's character in Apocalypse Now.
Oh, yeah.
There's a moment where he says, isn't it kind of weird? When is this manic, mad sort of like a photographer in Kurtz's sort of like lair says, isn't it weird how God is dog backwards? And so there's this reference then that takes you through to Heart of Darkness, and it's kind of literary equivalent, it's filmic equivalent to Apocalypse Now. So this sort of like Soviet and American whatever. So then you have to reread the show backwards from the inside out again, sort of having seen it as a formal mass, then it becomes this narrative thing from the centre out. So that was the first show. And in a way, the first space downstairs is built in reference to that. And in a way, what I've tried to do with the work here, because, you know, they said, a retrospective. I thought, well, I don't think they're quite ready for a retrospective. Yeah, it sounds like I'm dead.
Mid-career
survey.
Survey.
I thought a survey was a better word, but also sort of like, but how do I, you know, how do I actually sort of do that with these types of work? So in a way, I've reworked different works to somehow annex in other works right. in my own mind, whether right. you can actually spot them or not, so it doesn't matter. But sort of, so in some ways, Trading Station is present in this in the first work downstairs. So. Mm.
You said earlier on that there was a sensitivity towards your work. Do you feel vulnerable with your work, or are you quite ballsy with it? Once it's out there, you're like, make of it what you will.
Certainly, yeah, I'm vulnerable with it. Not so much, not so much critically. More it in itself, you know. Certainly, I've had to spend a bit of time repairing and fixing down things that got broken or taken.
Taken?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Which has happened before. And that does affect me, I must admit, because it does seem, you know, having found this stuff and installed it for 20-odd years, it's kind of a bit like... And, of course, it somehow misses the point, because once you take it out of the space, it becomes just a thing. You know, it has no longer has no resonance because it's not part of that whole in a way. So it sort of somehow misses, even if it's a gesture of, you know, great love, it's a misguided one, shall we say. Mm. So I do feel a vulnerability in terms of that. I don't think I'm that kind of ballsy about it, especially when it's up. When I'm building it, I'm also quite, you know, but there's a certain focus though when you're building it. You know, there is no sort of like turning back, and there is no sort of you know, you just have to focus and make it. So,
but is there a level of improv in your work? Do you have it? Because there's such sprawling, disorientating environments. Do you set out in your mind's eye, you can picture it completely, or are you sort of building it as you go along?
Often I find that I can picture it quite well.
Wow.
But having said that, there's definitely improvisation. I think that's actually very important. I think, you know, when I was at art school back in the 80s, especially when it was particularly sort of like, theoretical, sort of like, you know, you were being forced to read all these, or at least sort of like coerced into reading all these sort of like heavy duty sort of
critical theory and stuff.
Yeah. Right. Oh, some of it very interesting and some of it utterly in one ear and out the other. I think when I left, I think that was the thing when literature came in, because the stuff I had read and had actually stayed with me from theory, I started to find far more sort of, shall we say, sort of soluble in literature, and far more enjoyable. And also it taught you that a lot of younger artists were using theory to somehow make art, but it just became an illustration of theory. And ultimately, what you really want to make is what the theoreticians look at and make their theories from. And to do that, you've got to have some...
Like what, for example, what would that be?
What, a theory?
What would a theoretician look at and make a theory from?
Well, kind of, you know, there's so many theoreticians would write in reference to, say, Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
Yeah.
Just because it's just so sort of like incredible. Yeah. You know, it's a story, but ultimately what it talks about in terms of philosophy and in terms of sort of like history.
Psychology.
In terms of, yeah, psychology, everything. Yeah. Sort of like it's a neuroscience, everything. It's all in there, sort of ultimately. And yet that's just a story. And it's a story that can be boiled down even to a children's story, sort of in many ways.
Yeah.
But it's all there, sort of. And I think, so to be able to make something like that, that can actually sort of inform, you know, the big brains that write this stuff, then that is the more kind of suitable position to be in. Well, also, I'm no theoretician, so, you know, it's like I'm not really claiming to be in. So, but to be able to make something that can...
It's multi-layered, multi-nuanced, and you can read into your work on so many levels. It is very psychological.
Yeah.
It's very disorientating. It's also playing with this permission to trespass.
Yes.
You know, we see these buildings, you think, do I go in? Is it dangerous to go in? Am I allowed to go in? There's a fascination, but there's a fear.
Yeah.
And you tap into that, which is a very kind of zeitgeisty society feeling that we all sort of have. We have like a voyeuristic approach to the world now, is that we all want to know what everybody's doing at every point, the Big Brother feeling.
Yes.
But these places you create are devoid of people.
Yes.
As an actor by trade, me, I would love to get involved in these spaces and do a play. But the fact is that you don't, we see the remnants of humanity. We see where they've been, like you're saying, the chewed bones, the dog bowl, the dog would have been there. People would have been there, but they fled. It's the Mary Celeste.
Yes.
You know, what's left behind. And we're allowed to suddenly trespass into what felt like it was incredibly inhabited and a hive of activity.
Yeah. The idea from the early 90s, when I shifted into this from the work I was making perhaps at college, was this idea of a hybrid script where I'd take a reference to the site I was making in, a reference to a political situation going on at the time and a reference to a fictional or a literary or a filmic sort of other, and then mix it all up and then sort of make this object, which is like a residue that would be a catalyst for the viewer, whether it might be, sort of whether it be the great big the theorist or whether it's, you know, the milkman or whatever, to come along with their own histories and then with their own histories to add to that script.
Yes.
And I think that's probably what has been the most successful in that, you know, I got sent a lovely email by a Turkish architectural model maker, I think, and filmmaker the other day, which I need to reply to, but it was the most fantastic, and it was full of theory in the answer, which is very interesting theory, but it was also very sort of felt and sort of like, you know, human response. And I think the last line was something like, you know, thank you for making this exhibition just for me. And even though they knew that I hadn't made it just for them, they understood the sort of like the complexity of the fact that I'd just made it for a lot of people, you know, not just them. But for them, they understood that this was, it felt so personal to them. And that's,
wow, that's incredibly touching.
Thing. Yeah, well, you really said touching, yeah.
Making sense of the world through our own histories.
Yeah.
So we make a sense of the world that you present to us through our own history, through our own projections.
Yes.
And it's like choose your own adventure in these spaces.
It is, yeah.
And it's triggering. Yeah. It's hard. They're hard.
You know, certain objects can just bring so much up for so many people, but on different levels, kind of, you know, and it's, and I think when you talk about ad-libbing or kind of like...
improving.
I think that's where the sensibility that kind of comes in. I suppose these scripts or structures were almost like arenas in which I could play, because they'd become like a kind of a narrative or a structure which would have given it like an arena almost, which were kind of pushing a certain idea or a certain understanding of an artwork you towards it, but not actually saying what you have to think about it. But within that, you could actually sort of, I could get to play, which is what I want to do, because that's the enjoyable bit in terms of making art. But it also sort of like is the enjoyable bit for the visitor to look at and to, you know, to make sense of. It's like the language, isn't it? It's like prose. And as you get older, you realise it's, you know, the formality is the prose. And like you can actually write about the most banal thing, and if the language is beautiful, you'll still want to read it. So
it's intergenerational though, because it feels like a computer game as well at points.
Yes.
Like, you know, these kind of dark ones where you're kind of hiding. And
PlayStation asked me to do a project many
did
years
they?
Ago. Really? Years ago, back in the early 2000s. But it was more just with to do with advertising. It was nice they picked up on it, I thought. But actually, I was slightly disappointed because I thought they might actually make, you know, the Coral Reef into a game, which I thought that would be quite interesting.
Amazing.
But they didn't. Oh. Like, no,
still
they
could after listening to this.
Yeah. They just wanted to make something that's an advertising sort of thing, but it never worked out. You know, it was too expensive and too much effort.
You know, the one thing I really think about your work is that person who mentioned that, thank you for making it for me.
Yeah.
Art, every single person that sees it differently. There is no, like, you know, actual version of anything. It's kind of like so open. But I think your art really highlights that, because if you, like today, we're going in just with you, there's three of us going to walk around the exhibition, but we're going to have a very different experience to if there's like 50, 60 people in the room with you walking around it. And I noticed in a lot of the reviews and criticism around the show, and also people I've known that have visited it, they all have picked up on this thing of going through it with other people and there being some kind of like psychic connection between each other, and how emotional it felt at certain points throughout the show because they were with other people, almost like journeying through.
Yeah.
I found that so fascinating, this idea of kind of like subconscious, they're not even talking to each other, but there's some sort of empathy, some sort of deep soul.
Safety.
Subconscious,
it's like, are you here? Are you looking after me? Have you got my back? Because they feel disorientating, and at times they feel quite violent, I felt, in them spaces.
Yeah,
threatening.
Like the identities, yes. But I suppose but you know ultimately that it's, you know,
in an art gallery
structure.
Yeah, like a construct, yeah.
You do,
yeah.
But you trick yourself. I mean, I do as an actor. I allow myself to kind of go with them emotions of being immersed in this sort of adventure. Do you know what I mean? Escaping from someone or in hiding or trying to be as quiet. I imagine a lot of people are quiet in there. You don't get a lot of noise.
I don't know. I tend not to go in when it's open. Again,
that's interesting. What is that?
Well, probably back to the vulnerability thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it when I like to build it. I like that being in there with the people I build it with. But when it's open to the public, it's somehow, I'll just be sort of too busy looking at what they're doing. Like, you know,
Don't steal that. Put that down. Yeah. Stop stealing everything.
I'm better off not in there, sort of like, but it was different with the Asset Strippers. I could walk around there, and that was quite nice in the Davine.
This was in 2019 at the Tate, Britain.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What was that exhibition then?
That was a sort of a huge exhibition of monumental sculptures made out of the kind of remnants of British industry. I mean, generally, you know, Clary had asked me, Clary Wallace at the Tate, to do a work for the Davin Galleries, which was really constructed in 1937 by with the money from Lord Davin, who sold art to industrialists. And it was quite I think it's quite a fascistic sort of like hallway. I mean, it has the sort of aesthetics of the 1930s somehow, kind of, you know, within it. But it also reminds me of sort of like the Cass room in the V&A, and also the...
I love the Cass room, Cass Court.
That's where I used to go when I was on the Dole in the 90s.
It's incredible.
Yeah, there in the lower rooms of the British Museum. And so you think, what's in there? You know, these monumental sculptures, many of which we, you know, acquiesced sort of like through sort of our imperial kind of history, sort of most of that paid for by industry. So, you know, what are we in now? We're in the end of this epoch that has made us this rich, powerful sort of like empire.
Empire, yeah. Rule Britannia.
Exactly. So yeah. I thought, well, maybe I should make monumental sculpture from the last remnants of industry. And where would you get that from? Of course, from the epoch that somehow superseded it, sort of from the internet, because that's where you can get anything from these days. Mm. And all these liquidation sales on the internet of companies going under, sort of disappearing, becoming sort of like obsolete. So that's where I got it from.
Asset stripping, I guess that's exactly. Where it came from. Makes me think of Pretty Woman. Do you remember at the end of Pretty Woman where Richard Gere goes in and they're going to asset strip all the companies down and then they end up building the company?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. I don't know if anyone's been talked about Pretty Woman in your work before.
It was glamorous in those days. But now it's a bit bleaker, a bit more close to the bone, as it were. So then I bought all this machinery and material, some from public institutions like the NHS, things from sort of agriculture, things from sort of like, you know, woodworking shops, metalworking shops. In fact, a great big electrical engineering factory in my hometown, Loughborough, sort of like where my cousin used to work. I bought a load of stuff from the Brush from there, which was quite nice because it was quite personal. But also the stuff they made, because they made in-house these incredible steel, you'll see them upstairs, steel sort of like trestles and stuff. And then constructed these kind of monumental sculpture that somehow would I suppose rift or sort of like were referential to sort of post-war British sculpture, like the Henry Moores, the Lynn Chadwicks, kind of and the Epsteins. I suppose it talked about the fact as well that those machines made that type of work possible as well. And that type of work somehow influenced the design of those machines and vice versa. So it's this cyclical sort of thing where sort of like design influenced art, influenced, you know, design sort of, but also facilitated the making of it. And so in all these galleries on either side, you have these sculptures that look quite similar, but to these machines, kind of just really, it was just, most of it was just stacked on a cast big concrete stands for them, and then just stacked them up, sort of spreading the weight, balancing sort of, and I think there's probably about 40 in the whole space.
The ready-made is important to you, like Duchampian.
They're slightly more than ready-made because they're collaged, you know, because there's more than one object normally, sort of like it might be like a steel table with a welder on it, or it might be a, there was one which had three great telegraph poles with a concrete ring, sort of like a ratchet strapped on top of, you know, a couple of trestles and on top of a load of lorry tarpaulins, kind of from Hull. Sort of like with all the sort of, you know, the painting and the phone numbers and whatever. Yeah, incredibly. And it was quite emotional. And then even we boarded off all the walls there and to the two corridors to sort of break up the space further on at the back. And all the timber for that came from an old barracks in Shrewsbury in Shropshire, where they sort of like had stripped the kind of like the armed forces, as it were, this sort of 19th century barracks, beautiful timber. It's quite interesting, though.
It is. It's like a feeding system.
Oh. Yeah.
But is your work like a feeding system? Is there a level of sustainability or recycling? Like the show we're going to see now, and you said it's a survey and you brought past projects back. If the work hasn't been placed with the museum or a collector, does it get recycled and become something else?
It hasn't. I've just kept them as works. I've been storing it
like a bundle of that project,
which I find so far out, because the idea you can just store all the stuff, like and you've been storing it all over the place, haven't you, like all over Europe?
Yes, even. I've got a gallery in Italy and a gallery in Germany and a gallery in New York, and they all store stuff, But we couldn't bring anything from New York because transport now is insane.
Yeah. It's so expensive, yeah.
Yeah, whereas land transport isn't so bad. So the remnants of the Venice Biennale came up from Turin, and the remnants of the asset strippers came from, and also from the studio apparatus came from Berlin. And then the rest of it came from my storage in the East End. I've got a big shed up in Scotland. And so that was full. I hadn't been in it for a decade.
Would you class yourself as a hoarder?
No, I wouldn't actually. I was discussing this with Rachel the other day. Rachel's my partner, Rachel Lowe, sort of. Because actually the stuff, I mean, I do like stuff. If anything, in the house has got too many clothes in. I buy a lot of old clothes. I love old clothes. It's been like, you know, I remember Jarvis Cocker saying years ago, any difference in his life now is that he pays kind of like 200 quid for something he used to pay 50p for in a jumble sale. I can relate to that. Yeah, that's kind of like the truth of my sad life now, sort of like. But in terms of all the material is related to exhibitions. So, you know, you wouldn't call Cara a hoarder because he's got a load of steel and a load of artworks hanging around, would you? Mm. Sort of like, so it just happens to be the work. So, you know, obviously I do like matter and material to make from, a bit like the big old resin tub that my dad brought back.
But that's what I mean, that, like, the asset strippers feel like it relates to your dad coming home with this object that was from a factory.
Yes, and then I'd be making this stuff out of it, sort of, yeah, very much so. I mean, I think, maybe that's, again, one of the things I've been successful with is that I've managed to turn things of no interest or of no value into...
But discarded, overlooked, suddenly become precious.
But I've also felt subconsciously in your work that you have a real care and almost like a kind of love or something towards these parts, you know, that they become the thing, and to the histories and to those communities. And even, like, I know in asset strippers, I think some of the tools, say, have, like, you know, so many people's hands that would have been holding them and using them that you can almost, like, see the kind of marks from where their hands have kind of, you know,
of course,
and that kind of imprint or, like, fingerprint or that kind of, like, history. And it really touched me because I was like, that's really interesting, because there must be some duty of, like, I don't know, like, care or love within it, I think.
Well, certainly. I mean, I would go back to my dad. I mean, it was the one thing he'd get angry with me for was if I left his tools in the garden to go rusty, which occasionally we did when we were using them when we were children. Yeah,
right.
So,
right.
You know, his tools were very, you know, it was very a kind of hallowed sort of area. And in fact, I, you know, dedicated that show to my dad. So, but I mean, yeah, it's the thing about that anthropomorphic, that sort of like aspect of the sculptures, because they were quite anthropomorphic as well, the sculptures and the asset strippers. I mean, if we were to think of like a winged bull down in the in the British Museum, and then some of these constructions certainly had that sort of mass and sort of like, you know, you could almost, they almost look kind of animal-like or human sort of like at times. And I think that sort of presence of that, but also the presence of the people that work them as well, is quite a kind of heady mix in many ways. I mean, that was the thing I was most worried about with the asset strippers, was being, you know, patronising. You know, to wheel in a load of people's old tools and then stick them up on plinths and in the Tate Gallery could sound like a terrible idea, you know, on many levels, you know, for the people that worked on them. And going back to actually walking around and looking at it when people were in, it was much easier than, you know, being caught up inside one of the, you know, constructions. But I remember talking to a guy who'd come down from Glasgow, and he'd actually worked on one of those welders, the very same one. And he was, you know, he was almost... Yeah, tearful.
Really?
He was quite moved by it. He didn't know who I was. He used to build Hillman Imps up in Glasgow back in the...
He used to build what?
Hillman Imps.
What's that?
It's a car. So, a bit like a Mini, but a bit cooler. They used to use them for rally driving and stuff. They were nice-looking cars. But he used to build those up in Glasgow on these very same welders.
Yeah, that was his projection onto it then. Yeah. You made that work for him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no.
But I also feel like the way you construct them, there is a kind of seriousness to it. So it's not frivolous or like... you know, insulting or anything. It's like, I actually think you're almost making people wake up a bit and to look at what's changing and to look at where we're headed as a society. Yeah. Because when I leave your installations, I start wanting to like touch the sky. I'm kind of like, is that real? Like, why is this the consensus? And consensus is such a word I keep thinking about, because society is basically a group of people that's agreed on something. And then you all agree on those values. But actually, when I leave your installations, I sort of feel like I've been shaken up a bit. And when it comes to waking people up, obviously the title of the show is Extinction Beckons. I've always felt like your work's very open and it's not didactic and it's not telling you to believe anything. It's almost like you have to find it for yourself, which is true of all politics in a way. But is there something that excites you about sort of sending people on this journey?
Well, the title Extinction Beckons is an old title. Again, it's a repurposed, like I've repurposed everything in the show. That was actually the title of the first catalogue I did in 2000 with the Coral Reef at Matt's Gallery. Mm. And in fact, I have to sort of like thank my friend Jackie Irvine, because it was when I was sitting with her and she said, why didn't you call the book, because she'd written all the text in that book years ago, why didn't you call it that? And she pointed at this helmet, an old motorbike helmet from the 70s and covered in old stickers, and one of which says Extinction Beckons. And I thought, well, that is a good title, sort of like, because there's something about... There's such a humour to it, sort of like, you know, it's really dark, it sounds profound, but actually sort of like it's kind of just some biker joke, sort of like, there's no way this thing on my head's going to save me when I hit a bridge at 70. Yeah, right. You know, it's, but also the word, even in the language of it though, the word sort of beckons is such a sort of strange.
It's totally.
Because sort of, it does sort of suggest that sort of like somehow, you know, you want to go to it. And I think
or
there
it's
is
inevitable.
Yeah, there is something about us that somehow, you know, of course we'll be extinct at some point anyway. Yeah.
To me, I've got Brian Blessed's voice in my head going like, Extinction Beckons. Or like Ian McKellen or something. There's some kind of like, I don't know, like that era.
Do you personally source everything, and do you work solo or do you have a team?
No, I source everything myself. I would say Asset Strippers, I did it with Paul. Paul Carter, a good friend and sculptor who helped me build the Coral Reef originally. I've known him since then. And he doesn't do so much of the heavy work now, so he was helping me do the... We'd sit on the computer looking at the... Because I hated doing that. Trying to find things on a computer is not for me.
But eBay's your friend, though.
No, I don't do eBay either. I mean, normally I'm just picking stuff out of markets. For years, I was just going to the car boots and markets all around the world, you know, world, really. You know, we'd be going around in the architectural salvage yards, been to some of the weirdest places, you know, buying them off a mullah in Istanbul who was redecorating his mosque. And, you know,
they must be thrilled when you turn up, because it's exactly the stuff that seems to be no one else was looking at.
Well, that is true of 20 years ago.
Right.
But I'd say now, you'd be amazed what people want. Sort of like, it's actually quite irritating. Sort of like, but I suppose I... possibly part of that set problem by...
I love the slowness of it. I love the fact that it's not like a quick thing to make a mic show. It's like you have to have years of dedication.
Well, part of the pleasure was, you know, you go to Sao Paulo and you're trying to find some sort of decent timber to build. We built this sort of extended the curved wall of the Oscar Niemeyer sort of pavilion in Sao Paulo. And we couldn't screw into the floor or the ceiling, so I had to build off a platform, and then you had to sort of like, I had to find some timber and hardwood, because it's all hardwood out there, it's hideous to build with, sort of like, so I'm trying to find some softwood, and I found this 19th century Baltic pine, 3x2, 10-11 meters long, sort of like each piece, absolutely so straight. And what they used to do is when they were taking the hardwood, obviously they had to go bring something back and forth to fill the ship up with. So I used to bring some construction timber. So I was lucky to find it. But looking all around the salvage yard that's outside of Sao Paulo, and in this sort of like twin city called Gorillas, we found it in the end, and it was the most bizarre space, you know. I remember sort of like rummaging around. It was kind of just getting to dusk and sort of hearing something sort of like in the corner of this building, and looking down, and this... a dog the size of a small donkey sort of was looking through the window at me, sort of like this barred window. It's like, oh, God. But
it's incredibly vernacular then, the way you work. Like you were saying, you were doing the project there and you looked in Sao Paulo for the materials.
Oh, yeah, no. I've been rummaging around Sydney, Melbourne, sort of San Francisco. I did a big project out there in Oakland. I used to buy off this lovely Mexican guy with the most bright blue eyes, sort of like down in San Leandro, down at the bottom of Oakland, sort of. And I think he used to think, what on earth is this man doing? Sort of like, I was buying all this hardwood timber, so I was reconstructing the interior of an old 1953 bus, and then I was panelling it with all the panels that came out of a housing project, you know, with the bits of graffiti and you know, whatever that had been written on. Sort of, so, you know, it's very interesting. That's a bit I really enjoy, I must admit, sort of. well, one of the bits I really enjoy. Obviously, making it's enjoyable, but actually finding the material as well sort of is good.
I heard you mention Istanbul, and I was mentioning to Russell earlier because he's obviously a huge dog fan. He has three dogs. And I know that when you showed in, I think it was in Turkey, you...
No, it was in Bucharest.
Oh, it was Bucharest. Okay.
The educational exhibition for dogs.
Yes, yeah. Exactly, for stray dogs.
Yeah, what was that? For stray dogs?
Yes, it's amazing work you made.
It was, in fact, that was a very important work to me in many ways, even though I don't think anybody saw it. Not even many of the dogs even sort of... But it was in 1996. I'd got a residency, which was part of the Pepinieres European Union thing, which unfortunately won't be open to anybody anymore, but for artists under 30.
Like a residency.
Yeah, and I wanted to get as far south and east as I could because I love going south and east, you know, towards the Middle East, really. And Bucharest was as far south and east as I could get.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
So I'd written a proposal kind of based on the idea of Soviet science fiction and the idea of bypassing the censors and sort of but trying to do it, you know, that's Soviet science fiction, but in a post-Soviet situation in like a post-Soviet state like Romania, and to see if it would still work, because you're not really quite sure who's in power, you know, after communism, who was in power. As it turned out, in Romania it was pretty much the communists, but rebranded sort of like So anyway, we turned up and Rachel came with me and we got £1,000 a month. This was an absolute small fortune in those days, to me anyway. But in Romania, it was like a king's ransom. So we could live off this quite well and also save money to live off for another few months afterwards. And when we got there, you went to get a flat and a studio and a show, you know, and obviously and a connection to the art scene there. And the woman that was looking after us, she just never seemed to sort of like, she was always either got a toothache or her mother was dying, and sort of like, and she took us to this sort of like room in between two typing pools in a comedy theatre, the most bizarre sort of space, sort of like where they're doing all these Ben Jonson plays, but all in Romanian.
Two typing pools?
So this was in the offices at the back of this comedy theatre. So 8 o'clock every morning, the typing would start, you know, proper old school typing. And we'd be sleeping in this room in between and sharing a bathroom. And it was a toilet with a sink. That was all we had. And with no communication to anybody. So we weren't really quite sure what we were doing there, but I was getting paid, so I was staying.
What year was this again? Sorry.
96. So it was only a few years after Ceausescu. So it was pretty raw. You couldn't find food half the time. I mean, the spring came in and then the food came in. But actually, when we first got there, and it was March or something, it was quite kind of quite difficult to find stuff. And there was very few restaurants. There's a few. That she used to go to. But anyway, nobody showed us where anything was because this woman, Roxana, never got in contact with us. So there we are, sort of sitting in this sort of like room which had like a single sofa bed, which we bought another mattress from the market. And then we had a sort of great big, one of those sort of radiogram things. It had one of those huge radiograms in it. It just used to play one channel called Radio Romantique. And it just used to play sort of the Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd. And just constantly sort of... And then we looked...
So dystopian.
It's incredible. Yeah. We bought a little sort of two double hob and the window overlooked our courtyard of the theatre where all, you know, sick people go.
An infirmary type thing.
Kind of thing, yeah. But there was just all these old men in striped pyjamas sort of smoking fags out of these barred windows. Like
a prison.
But exactly. It was a kind of a strange mixture between sort of like prison and hospital.
Right.
There's a particular name they gave it, but sort of, and they used to look at us and we'd look at them as we were cooking along. And we spent this time there and we, the only people we seen weren't people, they were dogs. The streets were full of dogs. Imagine Oxford Street, every sort of 100 foot, there'd be a pack of 20 dogs just hanging out, sort of like, you know, they're just there. I mean, the Contemporary Art Museum, or Contemporary, wasn't really Contemporary, but the Art Museum, you know, had its kind of two sets of doors. And in between, there was a dog with puppies, you know, with its litter of puppies. And they were just running in and out. So people didn't seem to mind. They were very nice.
They were nice to the dogs. They treated them with respect, or was it?
They seemed to, yes.
Right.
It wasn't like, what I've seen in some countries where they just cull them. And in the end, in fact, now I think they've done a sort of like a mass sort of like...
kennel type thing. Or like
no, where you sort of like get rid of their kind of ability to have puppies.
Oh, like they new to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sort of
to control the population.
Spayed them all.
Spayed them all. Sort of like, so, which was a humane thing to do. But they didn't do a mass kind of, you know, which I've seen in other countries.
Yeah.
But so it's actually sort of like they seem to have done a relatively good job of it. But they were there everywhere anyway, and we became friends with some of them. The sort of like the sad-eyed dog, the fat dog, the crocodile dog, sort of like there was a bunch of them we used to know, you know, sort of like so. Then we just travelled. We just get on trains and take a sleeper train across the country, and with a tent and a couple of sleeping bags, and sort of like sleep here and there and everywhere. And it was kind of very interesting.
What did you do for the dogs, though? What was the
thing? Well, in the end, sort of like the woman Roxana was meant to be coordinating us. She sort of like got hold of us and gave us the space, the Academy of Art sort of like exhibition space, which is a strange old space anyway. And so I just dragged all the stuff in off the streets. And made this educational exhibition for dogs, which was, when you walked in, it just looked like a space stream of rubbish. But within the rubbish, there was 40 different sort of tableau and objects about why we're human and they're dogs. So it'd be like a sort of tattling tower made out of the kindling with a small dog made out of an old box and a football. But it kind of, it's almost fallen to the point where it doesn't look like it's anything. Sort of there'd be like a distillery talking about alchemy with bits of all rotting fruit on the floor, and then there'd be a broken sink with a plastic fish and a plastic crayfish, and the other half like a, you know, the evolutionary split when the fish grew legs and crawled out of the sea. Sort of there'd be a whole alphabet of sort of like made out of different material, sort of a compass made out of a big metal tin box, you know. And
but the dogs weren't invited in.
Well, they were invited, sort of like, in fact the invitation card was with me drawing a square and a triangle and a circle in the earth with a dog looking really interested, sort of looking down at the end of the stick. Of course, there was a bit of sausage on the end of the stick.
Yeah,
that's why I was so interested.
Yeah.
But he did look really learned. He was called Vasilis. He was a nice dog, sort of like... But apparently he wasn't allowed to go as far as where the academy was because the other dogs controlled it, and those dogs didn't come in, unfortunately. But I suppose the absurdity of the thing is that the material strewn on the floor is... As interesting or as educational to a dog as what I made out of it ultimately. Mm-hmm. Sort of, and I suppose that's often the sort of thing with my sculpture, and I suppose refers back to, say, the Strugatsky brothers and a book like Roadside Picnic, where, you know, the idea of sort of matter, within that book, there's a visitation by aliens. The stalkers go in to try and get the stuff back, and the university educators look at it to try and work out what the message is they're trying to give us about why they came. And then there's one moment they say, well, it's just like a roadside picnic. They came, they kind of had their sandwiches, they chucked the crust over their shoulder, they changed the spark plug, and it means as much or as little as that. And that's the thing between material and sculpture, I suppose, and that ambiguity and that kind of being on the cusp. And I suppose that's why it was important for me, that show. But also that's where I met Leah and Dan Pajowski, these two artists, who one day I was working in there, they said, oh, you're making an installation, and they said it in English. And nobody seemed to be speaking to me in English, and nobody's talking about installation. So suddenly it was like, who are these? And then when I was doing the thing with the dogs, I met them again, and they took me up to their studio, and then they showed us everything in Bucharest. There was, a place where all the artists went to bar. You wouldn't know where it was. It was top floor, block somewhere. There was a Soros Foundation. You could access all the information on the artists in the area. And I think what was interesting, that it became clear to me that our contact had purposely sort of like kept us isolated. And that idea of like a closed system, which was kind of the system of control that the Soviet Union used. So having gone to Romania to make a work about sort of like trying to make, you know, sort of this narrative about sort of the post-Soviet sort of structure, I had somehow become the subject of the narrative as opposed to the narrator of it.
Wow.
And so it was an interesting trip, you know, in terms of the work, you know, that I made, but also
it just feels like your work, the whole experience, the whole was, like, yeah, your so work.
It was fantastic. We had, I mean, it was kind of bizarre, but fantastic, sort of.
And if it had been Istanbul, it would have been cats. I just realised.
Yes,
actually, Istanbul is like streets full of cats like that. Yes. Where you walk, you open a door, and then I actually stayed in a hotel once there, where you in the hotel room there was a cat who gave birth to kittens, and we had to like
in your own bedroom.
Yeah, and we had to sleep with them. And it was when I was with Dan Theo, and he was obsessed with cats.
I'd have actually loved that.
Yeah, it was very cute.
But the funniest that the Istanbul story like that though was when I went to collect the material for High Imposture in the British Pavilion. My friend Mary sort of said like, "Do you know any hotels?" In because she was kind of organising it, sort of like in Istanbul. So I only know the Yeni Hotel, which I used to stay in 1987, and again in 1992, and again in like it's kind of the one I used to stay in when I was a kind of teenager. And she said, "Okay," and I was like, "Oh," and anyway, she booked me in. It's kind of March, so it's pretty cold. And it's a real backpackers sort of like behind the sort of station place. And so we turned up, and I was a bit like, "Oh God, do I really want to stay here?" For like, so we went in, sort of like, and it's exactly the same. Portrait of Ataturk, the sort of like the fake rock sort of like a counter at the front, sort of a. But then there's this young guy, not the old guy I used to know, sort of like sitting behind it. So I said, "Oh, wait, can I take a look at the room?" I thought, "Better have a look before I go in." Sort of like commit myself to 10 days in here, sort of. And I followed him. I said, "Oh, I've stayed here before." He said, "Oh, when was that?" I said, "Oh, 1987. So it was the first time." He said, "Oh yeah, when was that?" I said, "In August." He said, "Ah, sort of like a." I was born then. And I said, "Really?" I sort of said, "Oh, what date?" He said, "Oh, 20th of August. I said, "Well, I know for certain that I was here that day when you were born." He was the son of the owner.
Weird.
Because that was my birthday as well. I turned 20 on that day, sort of like...
How weird.
I thought, my God. I felt like almost like it was my son.
Wow. Well, we're going to go see the exhibition now, which you've described as a glitch in reality.
My intent has always been to make immersive works. They should have a narrative, a spatial aspect, but also a psychological effect on the senses. You're seeing and feeling one thing whilst your brain is trying to override this and tell you something else.
So now we're going to go in. It's actually been so exciting because this is like Night at the Museum almost. Yeah, you heard people hoovering earlier. And
this is the entrance.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Oh, that is
not okay, so it's not the traditional entrance.
No, we're sort of... I think actually, in real terms, we're entering through the gift shop.
We are, yeah.
Yes. It used to be the gift shop, didn't it?
Well, your manifesto, then, you just sort of read, if you can call it a manifesto, is basically like something doesn't... This doesn't exist before, but it doesn't make sense. But then when you're here, you know it doesn't exist, but it still doesn't make sense. Nothing makes sense how it got here. It feels like it's always been here.
Yeah, it's kind of a schism in the mind, I think, somehow, when you kind of... You know that something has been constructed for you, but at the same time... Your eye is telling you something else.
Yeah.
And I think it's worked off that for many years. So anyway, this is the notice board, which, again, I've always had a slight problem with labels in museums. Mm. And this was something I wanted to deal with. So I made these for the exhibition, which are old notice boards, and then just cut to fit these old Perspex frames that I bought from my friend Andy in the junk shop a couple of doors down from me, who is an old friend of mine from a long, long time ago. We used to fight over things in the car boots in the 90s.
Did you?
Yeah. Then we became friends. It's often the way you start fighting and then you...
That's how we started, I think.
Yeah. The best way, sort of like...
So we're looking at Eye Imposter 2011 Various Materials. So this is a reconfiguration of a work from 2011?
This is the matter, the material from Eye Imposter from the British Pavilion.
So in front of us is stacked up and behind... Wow. See, it doesn't make sense because it feels like we've come into the wrong... point of a museum.
It feels like a storage
room. You're like,
okay, this is like lit in red as well, so it's like this kind of, we're kind of bathed in red light right now. It really, really reminds me of my childhood when my mum worked at the Natural History Museum.
Yeah.
And I used to spend all my time behind the scenes at the History Museum, and it was just like this with like dinosaurs though.
Yeah.
I suppose it really tricks you.
Oh, it's amazing. And the smell as well.
Well, this, I suppose, is once they're taken down, this is the kind of remnants of the huge construction, the British Pavilion. Again, when I mentioned before, Trading Station, the first show at Matt's Gallery, so which was a room of storage. So it refers back to that. But it also refers back to the first Turner Prize work, the Cosmic Legend of the Erebos Serpent, where I built a warehouse to store the coral reef within, on which I'd been nominated for the Turner Prize. So in a way, there's this sort of a kind of reference back, but it also seems quite a good place to start almost at the end, in a way.
We're looking at like 1,000 things in here, potentially, yes. Objects. Would you be able to know where every single object in here was from, where you sourced it and found it?
Yeah, yeah.
Whoa, you have yeah. that database in your head. So, like, there's a satellite dish over there.
Yeah, they're from Istanbul. Whereas that's actually Italian.
It's an old chimney, sort of, yeah, like a burner.
It was a fantastic moment in Venice, where because...
It's mad, yeah.
Because the Venetian Brilliant. Material isn't that different. That's, in a way, where the idea came from. I was walking around Venice and thinking, like, this reminds me of Istanbul.
Of Istanbul,
because,
yeah.
of course, it's got that Byzantine history behind it. And so... The stuff I bought, say, some of the doors are Italian and some are Turkish. Like, this is a Turkish one.
You're touching these. How do you feel about touch in your environments? Because it feels like, because they're installations, they're immersive. As a member of public, you feel like you want to hold onto the walls at some point or you're going to open a door.
Yeah, have to open a door if you're moving through them. So certain things, it's fine to touch and to sort of push. But certain things, obviously, the more fragile, smaller objects, they're going to break if everybody picks them up.
Yeah.
And takes them. So,
do you have when you're navigating your way through these labyrinths you create, do you have in your mind's eye the journey you want people to take, or you all, like, obviously make it disorientating so people have to navigate their own way through?
More different ones are different things, I suppose. I mean, the coral reef was very much an idea of trying to equate a literary structure to a spatial structure, and that literary structure was like a Borghesian one, but most particularly to a book by Stanislaw Lem that was very much in that ilk, which was called A Perfect Vacuum, where it was a series of reviews of non-existent books, where the first chapter is a review of itself, but argues it's just part of the anthology of short stories.
Trying to get my head around that.
Yeah, each
it's
room.
A review of itself before it's even...
Yeah, so the first room in the coral reef, if you remember...
And the coral reef, by the way, we haven't really spoke about that. It's then it was installed at Tate's
own it. But the first... room is a reception to the art gallery, but it's a fake reception to the art gallery, if that makes any sense. And the art within it, the idea of the art gallery, is part of the belief structures that then carry on, whether it be Islam or fundamental Christianity, or whether it was Marxism or sort of a biker gang or black magic, you know, all the different sort of kind of categories. So in a way, the coral reef was a complex and structure of fragile belief systems
but organized religion is quite a big thing.
Yeah,
which art could be one of?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Of course it is. Well, art sort of, I suppose, it represents modernity in many ways. Modernity, I think, it was a religion. It's the thing we've just lost, actually.
Yeah.
And I think it's the one thing that metered capitalism in recent decades, and now that's why we're in such free form now, ultimately. So yeah, and then the ocean surface. Above the coral reef is that of money, of capital, ultimately. Mm. So that's always kind of underpinned a lot of the work. And
what is your news channel? Where do you get all your political references from? Where do you pick up your news? Do you have like
Rachel, BBC? My other half?
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's a complete news.
So it's all received wisdom.
Oh, completely.
That kind of makes sense.
Where does Rachel? Where does
like
Rachel
filtered.
Get it from? Yeah.
Oh, she's the garden. She's like sort of I can't remember now, but she's looking at all sorts of places, but kind of pretty. Straightforward, not anything too outlandish.
Yeah,
sort of,
yeah.
This is a huge sort of bobbin to go back to textiles from that would have had spools of cloth on, sort of like.
So that's like a 9-foot giant bobbin that would have had.
It would have had textiles on, I think.
Yeah,
that's from the Caravanserai in Istanbul, because what this original show its beginnings came from was a space in 2003 for the Istanbul Biennale where. They asked me to do a project. They had about 10 grand, which isn't a great deal of money for a big project. So I went round the Istanbul of my youth and found this old caravanserai, this 17th century crumbling, which had been turned to an industrial estate, and found a room that we could rent, two rooms. And then I turned it into a photographic darkroom and then documented every room within the building. There's about 80 different rooms, all these different, like, casting aluminium. They were sort of weaving. They had these weaving machines. They were still using these, I think they might be early 1900 weaving machines from Switzerland. They were still working in this building, sort of like, it's not of that age, but it was all part of the same weaving sort of history. They were pressing trousers, they were making trousers, they were making buttons, they were doing all sorts of things in this building. It was incredible. It was like Hackney Wick, but sort of like in a 17th century caravanserai. And so in a way, the red light refers to that as well. And right. later on...
Oh, to developing.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so when image. I came to make the Venice Biennale, I took the negatives of the photographs of the building, which is all I had left. And then I built the building back around the negatives. So it's almost like a reverse.
Oh my God, it's like Inception or The Matrix, yeah. the way that your brain works when it comes to creating art.
So we're currently by these kind of shelving units, which are like industrial kind of ones. You can probably actually climb up on them. You shouldn't climb up on them, I will add, for health and safety.
No.
But you technically could if it was your storage facility. But at the top, you've got almost what look like sort of like ladders or something.
Stairs, and
they're quite ominous. Yeah, like stairs, yeah.
Oh, well, they're built from the building from in Venice.
So but also the weight of them, yeah, it's so intense, like that what looking up to them and that
the
heavy weight.
What is the safety thing for your work? How does, well, I mean, what are the conversations sure that galleries are having with you?
Well, I think it was quite good in, you know, doing the asset strippers in the Tate. And I think their thing there was if it balanced for a day, if it stayed up for 24 hours, it was safe. Which I thought was a great sort of like, you know.
The smell, I can't get over the smell, that kind of dusty smell. It reminds me of those kind of behind the scenes in old museums, you know.
It does feel like we're trespassing. It does feel like, even though we're with you, the artist, Mike, it feels like we shouldn't really be in here.
Totally. That's what's so exciting about it. Yeah, just gates.
Well, I think it does invite you to transgress, which I think in a way is its success is somehow its failure at times in terms of, you know, if when people do things to it or take things. I mean, it's kind of possibly part of that.
I was going to say, it's probably part of it, because the thing is, it's actually alive, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
We're just doing some pictures for the socials.
It is a nice red room, isn't it?
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
You know, and all the text on the boxes. It's like, yeah, it's so...
It's tricky. It's like visually. It is a glitch. You know, this is probably jumping ahead to the art heist, but for you, what is someone else's, like, trash that becomes your treasure? What is the ultimate thing?
I think it's always an object that sort of has a history of somebody that's occupied it with meaning and with that they've treasured somehow. And you see that, I suppose that's why tools are so interesting, because people, you know, they both treasure them because they like them, but they also need them, and they can have provide something for them, sort of. You see it in clothing as well. I mean, that's one of the other things. If I were to hoard anything, it's probably clothing. You know?
Like, you know, when buttons are sewn on, or like when people have patched things up.
Yes.
Especially with knitwear, because I'm obsessed with knitwear.
Yeah.
But when people actually have a hole from a moth and then people sew it up,
and then
you inherit that. I love all of that.
No, that
kind of layer of history.
If I had my curator's head on right now, which I've gone into, I would love a three-person show with you, Mohammed Sami, who's currently in a solo show at the Camden Arts Centre, and Lawrence Abu Hamdan. For some reason, do you know Lawrence Abu Hamdan, the sound artist? He was a Turner nominee a few years back, and they won.
He's really interested in like audio architecture. He shows a Maureen Paley.
Ear witnessing.
Ear witnessing. Yeah, he was in the Turner
and
project.
And people describe it through the sounds of their environment.
Yeah,
and then Mohammed Sami looks at kind of... political upheaval in Iraq, for example, and Palestine. Yes. Do you know his work?
Yeah, no. Well, vaguely, I think. Sort of like, I'm terrible at. Of late, I've become somewhat immersed in my own world.
Well, yes, a lot going on.
Not surprised. Yeah, this must have been the biggest.
But what do you think? Do you not think that'd be an amazing three-person show?
It would be. Yeah,
it'd
be incredible.
Yes.
What has this show actually been like to have to set up? Because I imagine this must have been incredibly emotional, stressful, even just on an organisational level, on a really kind of boring practical level.
It's been, I'm probably sorry to say, the least enjoyable show to build, because actually most of the pleasure for me comes in being immersed in making something, and I've been so distracted on this because there have been five huge works. I'm constantly jumping between. And then we had like, with a very short period of time in here, which is the most exciting bit, is when you're actually installing. Because we were in an Argos warehouse down in Orpington in Kent for 4 months, with me and about four or five of us on and off. And that was more perfunctory, because we were just cutting timber, measuring things out. You know, it wasn't like you didn't see something growing. Mm. You know, so that was more just everyday work. And then we only had 4 weeks when we got in here. When I was in here, I was literally being pulled left. I was literally doing laps around the place. You know, and I couldn't... Every now and again, I get to build something by myself, but very rarely. I was really just sort of talking, checking in, sort of answering questions, sort of like with all the people working on it, which isn't the way I like to work, really, to be quite honest. But it was a necessary evil on this one. And in the end, I was astounded we actually got it done.
And it says please queue here, so people have to queue, and then they get to go inside.
Yeah.
Oh, good, because I'm like gagging to get in there.
You've got to join the queue.
We've got to join the queue, actually, Russell. Yeah. The queue behind me now.
So can I open this door and we go in? All right, we're going.
You don't have to ask for permission, Russell.
We're going into a square structure.
Scary.
And the door shuts behind you. There's like a hinge on that.
It's like
doesn't stay open.
All the doors shut behind you. And
it's got a spring, proper spring.
In many ways, when you sort of like when you stood on the mezzanine years ago and looked down over the sort of structure, and you could hear the slamming of doors, it was almost like a sort of an unseen sort of performance of the people inside. You know, it's a slight kind of a like some sort of weird 60s sort of play where you can only hear it from the outside.
It's quite Hitchcockian in some ways.
It is. It's very Robert Morris as well, the box and the sound of its own making. All it sort of, it's got that aspect to it.
And why have you ever been asked to engage with actors or performance within your...
Yeah, I was asked years ago, you know, by Punch Drunk asked me, like, a really nice, you know, sort of, I think Felix and Colin, they were doing something down at the tunnels under the old young Vic's.
The Shunts vaults
This is like going back 10, 15 years, so sort of like, I met up, had a nice time, sort of like chatting away. But in the end, it's not really what I do. I don't really want to, I want the visitor, it's sculpture, it's matter, it's object, but also the people I want to pour into it are those that just visit it as sculpture. So it didn't really seem to make sense, but it would, because they obviously were very interested in artists like me and those that before me that have made works like this over the years, you know. So
I love this kind of string, this kind of like nylon rope or something that's like,
what are we?
What is this fan in here and it's blowing against that?
This is just the reception, sort of like a
the reception of whatever it is,
whatever it is,
the public projects into this
space. Yeah.
Wow. But there's clues though, because there's numbers where there would have been keys hanging, perhaps, which suggests it's like different.
It's a fair size
rooms, and there's a hell of a lot of.
Did you
keys
make that key holder?
No, you found that.
No way. That's so
cool. Was you looking for that, or that came along and you went, ah?
It's the sort of thing I always would have bought and kept, you know, for the right space.
Talking of open, we're presented with two doors.
Yes, whichever you fancy.
I'm starting
Does
to get
Does that door
panicky.
Go somewhere?
Well, they all go
They
somewhere.
All go somewhere, Russ.
Pick which door. I can't pick. I'm getting
Well, I'm going to look in this door.
Yeah, I wanted to look in that one. I wanted to go in that one. That's the same as me. That's so weird. Oh,
come on then. Let's go that way. Now it's open. I want to go that way.
And this is how we get lost. We're literally entering the maze.
But
right
you
now.
Want us to get lost. That feeling of getting lost.
He wants us to get lost.
Ooh, creaky. So we're now walking into what feels like a kind of makeshift squat, like somebody's broken into a building and made it army, like sleeping bags are there and they've creeped in here at night and they're crashed out here. They're in hiding.
There's a yellow chair with tape.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny to come back in here because, like I say, this is a companion piece to the coral reef that was built just after. So a lot of the sort of interests in terms of the structures of, you know, society, belief structures, but also the idea of equating a literary structure to a spatial structure is still here. I mean, we were in Venice, we were very much dictated by the building we were built into. It's a very long, narrow space. And with the coral reef, it was very much constructed that you did get lost and there was doubling and whatever. Whereas this is slightly different in that respect. And again, that sort of idea of piracy, of sort of like of ships was very pertinent in relation to this in that there was three sort of texts as well as the sort of reference back to the migration of peoples across the Mediterranean. There was a reference to three texts, one City of the Red Knight by William Burroughs, The Many-Headed Hydra, which is a more historical text, and Temporary Autonomous Zone by Hakim Bey, which is kind of a theoretical book. But they all had one thing in common, which is talk about pirate utopias. And the title itself was a reference to two boats or ships that were constructed to take sort of settlers on to sort of Virginia after they'd been shipwrecked on the Sea Venture in the 18th century. And somehow this idea that kind of Bermuda was somehow painted this Isle of the Devils and it was this horrific place, but then their future lay in sort of Virginia. And a lot of it was forced labour being taken out there sort of to work in the plantations. Mm-hmm. It had a very short life. And when the shipwreck happened, the sort of like the structure of the hierarchy upon the ship sort of broke down and a kind of a more utopian community was formed on Bermuda, which was actually a very beautiful place. They found meat to eat from pigs that had escaped from a Spanish galleon years before, sort of like, and they were all actually living this nice life when these two boats are made by, anyway, one of the ones that's very much bound up with our troubled history, sort of.
Yes.
And they took the people back onto Virginia. So that's how why I named it that. But the idea of this community, which is they're often called pirate utopias, is touched upon in Burroughs' introduction in Cities of Red Night, where he talks about the doomed sort of like community of Libertatio on Madagascar back in the 17th century. So this was a reference point. And then back to Tempio Thomas's own, which talks about this the structure of the seaways, passageways of the seas, the merchant navy, and etc., in the same way the internet exists now. Then, because he was talking about back in the sort of 80s and 90s, the beginning of the internet, the World Wide Web, and the fact that that was that. So in a way,
Mike, it's so loaded. There's so many references that you... I mean, I'm obsessed with your references. However, someone who's coming into these spaces...
But even on a colour level in this room, I'm really struck by it, because you've got the yellow tape on the chair with this kind of grey wall.
Yes.
And then the sound in the other room that we heard of that fan.
Yes.
It's all, like, so sensory.
Yes.
Because the lights, they're like bare bulbs,
I love that trash can there. That
even
trash
your ring
great.
Right now is freaking me out, because it's like a skull and crossbones, the ring you're wearing.
Yes.
Bin. Where did you find this bin?
I think this one came from Venice, actually, but I love the fact
The sound is really... I've got headphones on.
Yeah, somebody has just stuck an axe through that, and it's made almost like crucifixes, isn't it?
Multiple axes.
Exactly,
that.
Yeah.
A corrugated metal bin that's all kind of charred, and then there's these big cross axe wounds in it. It feels very haunting.
It's a beautiful object.
It's really beautiful, but it's violent.
Yeah, no, it isn't, indeed, sort of a... But again, these are the sort of things that have no real inherent value, but somehow they're kind of charged.
Yeah, and it's like
charged. Yeah. What is the budget you give yourself for finding materials? Do you go like, I can only spend X?
Yes, I'm quite tight actually. I don't like spending too much on it, because it sort of kind of feels slightly wrong, sort of out. I mean, I've become more generous as I've got older. Years ago, it was very. I mean, like, on a show like this, we did the whole thing originally on such a tight budget. It was really.
Can I ask the budget?
Years ago, but to build this in Venice probably 20 years ago, probably was somewhere north of 50,000, 50,000 to 70,000, I'd have thought.
Was it hard to do it for that amount?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've got to think of the amount of material, the labour, the hotels.
This room, there are two sleeping bags. Now, that obviously is like a kind of indication that people have been staying here.
Yeah.
But also that's a motif I've seen in your work,
yes,
actually.
Sleeping bags
repeated.
Turn up sort of like a... I mean, obviously, this one's a Desert Storm one.
Yeah.
The print, which would have been still relatively new when this show was made. I remember coming across this, the first set of sort of fatigues of Desert Storm in a sort of second-hand junk shop in San Diego in 1991, and being completely intrigued by this, the fact that it would already become surplus within the time it was still being used, you know, in the first Gulf War.
So interesting.
You know, sort of, and so that pattern always is kind of remained with me, and you know, it's in a way, in terms of my life so far, of course things are changing rapidly at the moment, sort of like the war in the Gulf, and later on in Iraq has been such a huge thing ultimately. It's very much sort of, it has molded, you know, our lives, you know, and what's happened. It's not been in a vacuum in the Middle East. It's
changed the world.
It's changed the world. It's spilled out. It's affected so many people there.
Mm.
And us here, I think, sort of ultimately, sort of not so violently as there, but sort of ultimately it's, except, you know, that decision, you know, especially to go to war in Iraq in the second war, was, you know, a decision that perhaps shouldn't have been made.
Mm.
Well, it definitely shouldn't have been made.
And you arranged these sleeping bags as we're seeing them now. That's
They've been moved about. Every time I come in, I kind of give her...
There we go, and you're moving it right now.
Yeah, a bit of a shift.
Next room. Oh, my God.
Like, is this actually happening? Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
This is quite ritualistic.
That looks almost... Whoa, so we're like at a shrine now with...
And also that purple colour is so, like, religious, or, like, papal, or, like, royal
Vatican
as well.
Vatican or,
You've got the kind of ultramarine, haven't you, with the papal purple, so it's...
What are we looking at, Mike?
This is the room, if we were to think of this as a community, I suppose, this room would be the room of a non-denominational altar, I suppose I called it, where you can bring any object that has kind of a significance to what you want to worship and place it upon. So, and that's how I saw it. And it's a collection of objects that might or might not be of significance to one's belief.
And where did these objects all come from? The same place, or were they...
No, they've been picked up here, there and everywhere. I mean, the thing about the show in Venice years ago, as opposed to something like the Coral Reef, where I had the Coral Reef, I would have been buying material as I'm building it. Whereas in Venice, there's nowhere to buy it. So all this stuff would have been moved to Venice.
Hmm.
And then I would have sorted through it to make the work. So.
And who's that video of at the back?
Sai Baba, who's like a guru from the... We're very popular in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
And that's a video cassette tape.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like VHS. Yeah. And do the switches work, the light switches?
No, otherwise it'd be a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, if we switched it to everybody, we'd be switching them on
off. That's what I was just thinking. I was like, actually quite scared of that. Yeah.
I mean, it's...
I love all the doors as well and the actual fixings, like the locks and the handles, because they're also from different places.
All these doors are sort of like collected off the streets mainly in London back in 2001.
God, it's so weird. That one has the number
six. All original for 2001, yeah.
I wonder where that would have been.
It's like a guest house.
Yeah. And a lot of them came from Shoreditch Town Hall years ago. One difference in this work is that I've built it slightly in construction and in dereliction as well. So the knocked out walls you might have noticed earlier on, that is newer to the original. And also some of these spaces where it's not been painted. So it's almost like it's been left. And also all these little bits of... I've knocked all these out with an axe, just to give it a little bit of an edge off it.
To detail.
The thing is, if you think about energy, the fact you've done that with an axe, that energy stays in the room.
I'm going to take you this way, because originally you might not have gone this way, because you might have missed this whole section.
Do you find it hard to sell work then? Like all these objects obviously feed into so many systems you create.
Yeah.
If you sell it and you're not allowed access to it anymore, is that hard for you?
No, I'd be quite happy to get rid of it, to be quite honest. But it's amazing how few people are that want to buy something this big.
It's really hard. You're making work for institutions.
Even they don't want it.
Really?
Yeah. It's too hard to deal with on the whole. It's a very brave institution. It's incredible they bought the Coral Reef.
But it's amazing that then you don't... As an artist, that doesn't stop you from making what you want to make. It's no point you going, I need to place these works somewhere. It's this compulsion to create.
Yes. Well, I mean, in the end, it wasn't the money that motivated me to do it. Otherwise, I'd have gone and worked in the city. Mm. So, the kind of the highs from the making of the stuff, So
that's what
it's like.
But also, I've always felt like with your work, it lives on in the minds of the people that saw it.
Yes.
And then it almost becomes people tell each other about it.
Yes.
Well, exactly.
And that's like...
That really was the point years ago.
Yeah, and in a way...
It still is now, but I mean, I'm getting a bit old these days. Sometimes I'm like, I'm realising there's not, that level of input physically into something is getting kind of greater in terms of my reserves. And I think that's more problematic. Of course, I've got a lot more help now as well, though, to be quite honest. So it's like, but still, this has nearly knocked it out of me, this show. Look, somebody's kissed the mirror, look.
You didn't do that. That's not you. I think that's for you.
It says Lucy on it.
Does it?
Yeah, I can see the word Lucy, love. It's, if you move your head up and down it, and PB, there's a few things in there, actually.
Yeah, you can't stop people doing the things. I don't mind that. It's like,
Do you get a break now, then, from... Now you've installed the show and it's open. And...
No, I'm trying to sort out the storage of it. That's my problem now, sort of.
Storage issues.
Yeah.
Fire exit. Oh, that's such a weird fire exit sign. It says to fire exit, T-O.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah.
As if, like, you're going towards the fire exit. It's not the fire exit.
Yeah. It's obviously, it's...
In this structure now, what it does as well, it's disorientating because you feel like we're back in the room.
To be honest, I thought we were going back into the room.
I thought we were back in the room like four rooms ago. Yeah. And now we're
we'll be the next one.
The next one is. But it tricks you.
The thing is that this is a bit of an odd one because originally this would have been built in such a way in Venice that you had to walk back through it. And often you would have walked through one side and then you would have missed it and come through the other side. And in a way, that's part of the literary sort of like spatial structure of Cities of the Red Night, where it's got this sort of double narrative going on. One set in the sort of 17th century in the times of piracy, and one set in the current, the modern day when it was written in the 80s. Kind of and in a way, I think sometimes people either miss the room with the altar in, all this sweatshop type room, which
your doors often have glass in them as well, so you can see the previous room.
Glass.
And I've just realised that I thought I was in the room we were just in, because you've got this, what do you call that? The thing
door closer.
The door closer is this kind of like painted red or maroon almost. And it was the same in the previous room.
Yes, yes.
And I got so confused just then. And then I saw it through the window.
The clock's been slashed like Freddy Krueger's.
It has, isn't it? It does look. I mean, that's just as is. Sort of like...
Where'd you buy that?
That would have been a Carl Boot sale years ago. That would have been Merton Abbey Mills, probably.
And they would have loved you, because you'd have picked that up and said, I'm going to have that. And they'd have been like, what?
Exactly. You want to pay for that.
Oh, God, and this door's really freaking me out, because you can't see through it, and it's got the weirdest door latch.
Right, we're going to go back this way.
Oh, we are.
Oh, it's locked.
We're going to go...
Oh, no.
You can go that way.
You can go
out. You see where you are, if you like. So okay. Like, we're back
Oh, yeah, we're back here. Okay.
The only reason I'm showing you this way, because otherwise...
I didn't see that before. There's like a...
That locker.
Alex.
I like the fact it's like a body, you know.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
So that is Alex.
Weird. Alex. That's like a, what do you call it, like a gym locker?
Yeah, but a really battered old one. Sort
of. Ooh.
Oh, wow.
All these rugs.
It's all like mats everywhere.
Or like a prayer room or something.
Yeah. It's kind of an educational room, I always saw it as. Mm. For what education? I don't know. It's left open. I mean, like the altar room is left open. This is also left open.
I like the flip-flops and the wall.
Yeah.
You love a flip-flop and a wall.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Kazaa, they have the footprint of the inside. I mean, that, you know, for me was a very... That's why I bought them, because they're so incredible. Sort of like somehow the idea of that a faked footprint in a flip-flop. Yeah, yeah. You see them every now and again, but it's a particularly nice old one, sort of a... Yeah.
We can call for help. That's an old BT phone. God, that reminds me of the 90s.
So we're not even halfway through the exhibition, are we?
The whole exhibition, or this one?
The whole exhibition.
Oh, this bit is so pleasing to me. Just formally, like, even just the colour choices and like the shape of it. The blue on that wall with them, the lime there, and then the... It's so beautiful, this bit.
Oh, God. Need to push the chair over.
Oh, don't worry.
This is like a roulette table with cards, but like a makeshift one, and there's a poster of an East Asian
Chinese. With a little, presumably a little red book bound up in that in those packages. You see the woman steering has a machine gun on her back.
Oh my God, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah.
And but she's happy.
Yes. Well, she's looking to a brighter future under
with her machine
Chinese rule.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things I'm really focusing on now is this bit of tape that's covered in hair.
I don't know where that's actually come from.
It's really freaky.
Yes, that is not part of the show.
Just fell out of Rob's underwear, didn't it?
Russ!
Yeah.
What?
I don't know what it is.
Would you use that like for something else?
Caught on the floor.
Would you feel like that's just going to go in the bin?
Yeah. Right. See, I'm not a hoarder. I don't... yes, you know what? There was a handle on there originally. It's obviously... It's obviously come off.
Oh my God, we're trapped.
We're trapped.
Yeah.
I'm trapped with you in my nightmare.
I'm going there. Well, we better go in here. You haven't been on the roof yet either.
What?
Oh God.
You're kind of like, you're missing out on a... It's worth a sort of like a moment to stop and consider this one, because if you imagine when this...
Twin Towers.
Well, when this was built? In May 2001. It's kind of freaked me out, I must admit, you know, because it was built in May and then it was on until November, and then in the midst of it,
September.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all gone quiet. I mean, everyone listening to be like, what is it? But we're looking at posters of like a Boeing 757 and the A310 Airbus Singapore Airlines, and you built this at that point.
Yeah.
God, that's so weird.
And you've got these snow globes with Statue of Liberty and then the Twin Towers in
them.
In
fact, the Twin Towers is in both.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, these two snow globes, yeah.
And then the Sedgwick Global Natural Perils map.
Wow. God,
I must admit, it very much unnerved me when it happened.
You're a prophet in some ways.
Well, no, I just think it's one of those ridiculous coincidences that freaks you out. But
even the furniture in here is really like flight related, isn't it?
Yeah.
It kind of really reminds me of like... the early ideas of modernist flights or something. Like.
It's quite interesting, this room, because actually when we came to rebuild this, we had no plans. I had just my rough drawings and the notebooks from which we built it from years ago. And so we had to get all the stuff out and measure it up to make all the plans, to build the walls, to make sure it was all that. I mean, David Jones, who works with me, is superb. Sort of like, he did all that calculation And the guys that were working with us were astounded. It was millimeter perfect. Can you imagine building this and having this to fit in perfectly? Mm-hmm. From it's originally as it was. So this was built and this all just dropped in to fit.
God, I'm so confused where we are now.
We're back in the middle.
Right, you go first,
Ross. Sorry, that's kind of hilarious.
All the cables.
Tangled up.
Here we go. So if you could do an art heist and you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why? And also, what object, as I asked you earlier, is the Holy Grail? If you could have any objects in the world, what would it be and why?
I think I'd have a cave, a painted cave from, you know, sort of like Neolithic, you know, old times, sort of like a
from
cave,
like
cave painting.
Civilization.
Exactly. One of the first paintings. Then I'd have a cave as well, and then I could have a fire. Then you could have the flickering fire in the beginnings of cinema. So that's
wow.
What I have.
So, wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
When I was a child, it was yellow, but it'd probably be blue now.
And why?
Don't know.
Do you find yourself drawn to blue objects?
Maybe. Or red. I don't know. I like any colour, really. I don't really have a favourite colour.
I think you like wood. You like brown.
I like brown, yeah.
Definitely. Oh, my God, this is haunting.
Yeah, this is the one I was thinking about. So this is another sleeping bag piece, but inside is weighted down kind of bricks and cement.
So it's a bit like when you do a building job and any old sacks, you sort of fill them up with whatever.
Hardcore.
You always make too much concrete or too much plastic, you chuck it in a sack. And the idea of disregard to throw it into a sort of sleeping bag and the sort of sense of suffocation when you look into the face of it, I find
it's
quite...
It's really haunting.
Yeah, you know, it's like this, you know, in terms of development, you know, the development of property and the sort of like, I suppose, the sort of sense that most of that development isn't for the people that need to be housed.
No, exactly, and the forgotten people. Yeah. Is grief something that plays into the work?
Of course, yeah. I mean, like... It's one of those major things we have to deal with, isn't it? The amnesiacs, which we'll come to later on, was all born out of the death of a very close friend, Erland, that I used to work with, Erland Williamson, so fell off a mountain, rock climbing. So, but you know, certainly the death of my dad recently, you know, the last 5 years, was a very strong effect, especially with the acid strippers. We carry on upstairs.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
so, do you find making work helps you process those kind of confusing, you know, moments in life when...
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, it wasn't what I set out to do, but of course you use what you can, don't you?
Yeah,
when you're, whatever you do. But, hello.
Oh, you're getting told off.
That's all right. I think they're on a tour round.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
I'm trying to think. I think the best advice was from Christine Angus, and it wasn't so much advice as her opinion. And she was a stone carver at Reading, and she was my tutor, along with the people I mentioned earlier. But she was the person that told me when the work was shit, and she told me when the work was good. And she was correct.
And so honesty.
Honesty,
yeah. Honesty is the most inspiring policy.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Right, listen, everyone, you heard that reaction. We're going to say goodbye, enjoy the rest of the show because we've got 15 minutes, but we implore you to get down to the Hayward and see this.
And also climb the brutalist staircase we just climbed because that was even like part of your work. It's like you've activated the building.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I've never walked up there and felt the way I just felt. It's very strange. It's
this
perfect space for
what
it.
We're looking at now. Everybody, yeah, this is just so awe-inspiring. Congratulations. Thank you so much for...
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you for coming.
You've been so generous. And just follow the Hayward Gallery. You can buy tickets online. You can be a member, which then means you can see lots of exhibitions here. Thank you to the Hayward Gallery for giving us this opportunity as well, because Mike's one of our heroes.
This
and to
is
actually
incredible.
See this like this is just
wow.
Unbelievable.
Wow. All right, guys. Yeah, you
lots
have
of love. We'll
this.
Be back very soon.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5.
From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.